This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelä. And today's episode is the second one in a row on the anthropology of war, but looking at it from a completely different point of view. Last time we looked at war as it's evolving in Ukraine, about how it changes, or does not change, the psychology, the relationships, and the virtues of common people there. Today's one is about the big picture, about why does the human species wage war? And specifically, we're going to look at chimpanzees as a way to reflect back on ourselves. Chimpanzees are one of the very few species that, like humans, are known to sometimes gang up on others, even exterminate other groups. The most famous chimpanzee war was recorded in Gombe National Park in Tanzania by Jane Goodall, the legendary naturalist and one of my scientific heroes. But it's not just Goodall. In the episode description, you'll find a link to a short YouTube video recording a chimpanzee raid from a different community. And this video is truly worth a watch. Now, unsurprisingly, many have interpreted the chimpanzee record to mean that human war goes forever back, or goes back at least 6 million years to a common ancestor with chimps. And indeed, some very famous primatologists have suggested that human war doesn't really need an interesting social explanation. It is the biological norm that we're evolutionarily almost programmed to do. And yes, social institutions can secure peace, but our biology won't help. Now, long-term listeners might remember that in episode 8, my guest was Douglas Fry, who reached a very different conclusion. Fry, who is one of the leading anthropologists of war, said that all the available human evidence suggests that war is actually a relatively recent phenomenon, coming on stage less than 15,000 years ago, and in many areas much, much later. And by the way, this sounds way too rosy to be possibly true. I think slavery can be a useful analogy, because most histories of slavery would certainly not see it as something going forever back, but rather seeing it as something that evolves when you have highly hierarchical and settled communities. So perhaps war is similar. Oh, that was Fry's argument, but it was based on anthropology and archaeology. So what about those chimpanzees? Unlike slavery, war is something that chimpanzees also do. So it does seem to be something more rooted in our shared nature. And when I asked Fry about this, he told me that I have to wait. I have to wait until his colleague, Brian Ferguson, releases a book looking at chimpanzees specifically. Well, the book is out now. And my guest today is the author, Brian Ferguson. Ferguson is a professor of anthropology at Rutgers University and someone who, with Fry, has been a constant skeptical voice in the literature around the evolution of war. And while many might think that his conclusions are some of the softer ones, I have just time and time again found his scholarship to be one of the most hard-nosed ones. And so it's really worth hearing what he has to say on this topic. Before we get started, just a couple of quick housekeeping things to mention. First, this episode had to be recorded over Zoom, unfortunately. So I apologize for the sound quality being a bit less good than usual. I hope it doesn't distract too much from your learning and enjoyment. Second, I do want to say, as always, that the work that goes into researching, interviewing, producing these episodes is work that I really love to do. And it's work that I really want to be able to continue to do. But to do so, I need your support. Now, if you have just discovered the show, then please sit back and enjoy. But if you are a long-term listener, if you do appreciate this kind of work, and if you do want to join the small group of people who are already supporting me doing it, then please do consider doing so via patreon.com. You'll find a link to it in the show notes, or you can just Google patreon.com on humans. If you do so, I will, of course, send you a personal thank you note, and hopefully that will be more than that. It can be also a kickstarter to a conversation about the kind of things that you care about around these themes and things that you might want to hear in the future, or just any kind of things that you might want to talk about. Anyway, thanks for considering. I hope that you enjoy and learn something new from this conversation with Brian Ferguson.
Professor Brian Ferguson, welcome to On Humans.
Thanks for having me.
You started as an anthropologist of war in the 70s during the Vietnam years, and you were potentially even facing the draft.
Yes, I was facing the draft, and that really concentrated the mind. I wanted to understand why wars happened, why wars existed, and took me a while to get to college and get to anthropology and get to the specialty, but that's where it was formed.
How much do you think the interest came from a desire to prevent war as a kind of academic extension of campaigning against the war versus a more general kind of, you know, seeking solace in understanding a troubling phenomenon?
My father was a research pharmacologist, and he told me once, if you want to cure a disease, you have to understand the disease. And I've kind of taken that to heart. And so that's what I've been trying to do, to understand war. However, understanding it doesn't mean that it's going to end or that you're going to have even much input into it. But I think I'm writing not just for now, but hopefully it'll be read in the future, and that some dead ends may be closed off and open pathways for more productive kind of research. How it would actually be applied, I don't know.
Well, you're not the first person or the only person who, when faced with existing or looming wars, has wanted to understand them. You start with a fascinating anecdote from the, I think in the 30s, Albert Einstein had this really interesting interaction. I think it was just a correspondence via letters with Sigmund Freud.
Einstein asked, you know, why war? And he said, some things are obvious. There's the machinations of government. There's this and there's that. But he thought the real question is what inside people leads them to kill and often in particularly brutal ways others. But he already thought he knew the answer. And he thought he saw some kind of lust for destruction in human beings. But he asked Freud for some scientific backing for that or explanation of it. And Freud obliged with his own theory, which really I don't see carried on much today, if at all, which was that there is a kind of a death instinct that organic life, including humans, has a innate will to not exist. And that's a very bad thing to turn on yourself. So that through the psychological mechanisms Freud talked about, it could be turned and applied to outsiders, to others. So this death wish or death instinct or thanatos, I think was what he called it. There was eros and there was thanatos. And thanatos was the motivating factor for war and for the kinds of destruction and brutality that Einstein was asking about.
Yeah, and you say that that idea doesn't carry much weight, and certainly I haven't heard many people bring a full-on Freudian package to a discussion, but there is something, at least echoes of that, in biological explanations of war, not in the form of, well, life just doesn't want to exist and then it funnels it into something else, but in this idea that in a more nuanced, in a more specific way, there are instances where there is a lust to kill that emerges. So, for example, Michael Ghilieri says about war that it, quote, runs in our genes like addictive behavior, diabetes, and boldness. Continuing that, quote, anyone insisting that men do not possess an instinct to kill other men in certain conditions is in factual error, unquote. And to complement this, somebody might ask, okay, well, what are those conditions? Are they very, very specific conditions? And Richard Wrangham, who I've actually had on the show and who's done a lot of wonderful work that we talked a lot, but in this instance, I think that at least you will disagree with him pretty strongly. He says that what are those conditions? Well, they are, quote, when the killing is cheap, kill. Evolution has made the killing of strangers pleasurable because those that liked to kill tended to receive adaptive benefits. The rewards do not have to be anticipated consciously. All that is needed is enjoyment of the kill, unquote. And he even draws a kind of link between that and the enjoyment from sex.
I do spend a lot of time quoting Richard Wrangham and others because in discussing this in the past, I've been told that I was distorting his position, that he would never say that, but he does say that. And that's the idea that I think has gone large that people hear. I think that a lot of primatologists, and I call them panologists, because pan is the genus for chimpanzees and bonobos, just to separate that field of study from all of primatology that looks at monkeys, etc. I think a lot of young primatologists or panologists would not agree with that idea that there's this inborn tendency to kill others. But for whatever reason, they haven't really challenged it. And I think it needs to be challenged because, in a way, it's a public face of panology. That's what people think they say. My fond hope is that some panologists and primatologists will look at this book and say, good, now we can go beyond that. Because I don't think that's what most of them are. I know that's not what most of them are studying now, but they're saddled with this image. And the image isn't something that was only talked about 20 years ago.
For those who did listen to the episode, they might be a little bit confused, because a lot of the episode we spend on discussing how low violence on some metrics is in humans when compared to other apes. And I think, so the short, long story short, am I getting it right, is that Rangan believes and that humans are very friendly when it comes to our emotional temperament when we interact, especially with group members. We don't end up fighting nearly as much as even bonobos. However, he sees that we are very similar to chimpanzees in that both humans and chimpanzees have a very strong inclination to kill strangers, especially males killing strange males.
That's correct, yes. The basic observation that Richard Rangan would make, and I think many other people would make, is that you can, for human beings, you can go through most of your life without seeing some kind of a physical altercation. And with chimpanzees, you do see these things a lot, you know, this kind of aggressive behavior within groups. So there is definitely a difference there. I mean, I've made it a practice since I've been studying war. When I see two people fighting on the street, I always watch it. And I probably haven't had, since I've been doing this, 10 chances to see that, because it just doesn't happen. If you were looking at chimpanzees for all those years, you'd see quite a lot of it. So there is a qualitative difference there.
And I think the important thing that I was really fascinated by in our conversation with Rangan was that he said that, well, yeah, sure, there are communities where it happens really rarely. You know, Manhattan might be one of them. Kim Hill studying the Ache hunter-gatherers in Paraguay hasn't seen a single fight in 40 years. But what he also, and this is, I think, what was most important, is that he also said that people who have studied deeply disturbed communities who have been wrecked by colonialism and alcohol, for example, that even in these very, very unfortunately violent groups, you don't get near to the level that you see in the chimpanzee population that he studies. But I just wanted to clarify this here for those who haven't listened to the episode, just so that they have a little bit of a summary. And those who do have listened to the episode, that they kind of get where exactly are. Is there a disagreement? And am I right that the disagreement between you and Rangan would be in the way that he understands not, you know, fist fights on the street, but rather strategic violence, what he calls proactive aggression, especially where a group of males gangs up and systematically tries to exterminate a group of other males or an individual from that other group. So he sees us as very bloodthirsty species, yes, as he sees chimpanzees, when it comes to the way that males gang up on strangers.
Right. There's different permutations of that. And I should say that one of the things, when you get to the end of the book, or near the end of the book, there's a chapter where it's devoted to specifically how has this demonic males hypothesis specifically been applied to human violence. And when I look at that, what surprised me is that it's not a consistent message. There's things that are said in one paper that are not the same as in another paper. But the idea that chimpanzees are very bloodthirsty, this is the idea that I'm arguing against. And one thing that did shock me, but I'm used to it now, is that you'll see not just popular writers, but also field researchers who will repeat something like this, that when a number of male chimpanzees from one group encounter a single male from another group, they will take every opportunity to kill it. They don't have to be competing over anything. They just want to kill it. And that, appended to this general statement, this sometimes, it's said often, leads to the extermination of whole communities. That's not the record. This is not what the record shows. And I can say this because I've gone through the entire record. If you're talking about war, which I put in quotes when it's applied to chimpanzees, if you're talking about war of sequential killings of outsiders by members of another group, there are only two cases where that has been documented. Well, no, three occasions where it has been claimed that one group exterminated another group. One was the famous case of Gombe, which is what Jane Goodall made her breakthrough work on. And I look at that and I can pretty much accept that, although I think that some of the chimpanzees in one group weren't killed, necessarily killed. They may have left. Then there's another place called Ingogo, which is in Kibali National Park. And there's been a sequence of killings, but there's no suggestion that the group of victims was wiped out. And then there's a third case of Mahale, which followed quickly after Jane Goodall's initial observations, where a K group is often, and if you read the book, you see I just have an entire page of quotes saying that M group wiped out K group. There's no evidence of that at all. And it's surprising to see how widely that is taken as a fact when the only evidence we have of a possible killing is a distant ruckus that was heard up a mountain valley, and then one of the chimpanzees wasn't seen again. That's it. Otherwise, it's just disappearances. But chimpanzees disappear for lots of reasons.
Well, let's stop quickly, because I would love to get especially into the details of what happened in Gombe. I think it's very important to understand how the one-liners might mislead. But before we do that, to just quickly look at the big picture. So when reading through works, a lot of the works of people whose stuff I really love, I mean, from Richard Wrangham to Robert Sapolsky, these are just people that I absolutely admire. But you do find these, at least
they're great
suggestion.
Researchers.
They're great researchers, and you do often find this suggestion that what is species typical behavior of chimpanzees, what you should expect from a day on a chimpanzee tour, is that there is going to, that the males, if they see, that they patrol around their areas, and if they see a stranger, they will, if it's safe, they will try to kill the stranger. Mm-hmm. And that war is a relatively common occurrence in chimpanzees. And then what you find, before going into the details of when do killings actually happen, do I remember the numbers roughly right, that there are these two quote-unquote wars? And
right.
If you don't count these two quote-unquote wars, killings happen once in 30 years.
Yeah. Those two wars, and forgive me if I get the numbers wrong, but they amounted to 9 years of observation. And during those 9 years of observation, there was, I believe it was 1.7 outside killings per year. And in all the rest of research, it's 0.03 killings per year. And this is not my own data, which is basically along those lines, but this is using exclusively the data that those researchers produced. It's about once in a chimpanzee lifetime.
Yeah.
Outside of those years. And as I said, there are these new cases which still have to be, we need to know a lot more about.
Yes, And I guess the numbers can lie a lot. It might be that, I mean, I'm not expecting the every killing to be observed. I don't think you are, but just to get the order of magnitude right, it's once in 30 years that there are observations. And it really is not the impression that you'd get from almost any popular one-liner on a science article about what can chimpanzees tell us about violence. So I think that's one important just big picture thing to notice before we zoom into them, those two instances where there is something, perhaps we could say, you know, more intense, more troubling, more warlike.
I'll add on that certainly you don't expect to see every killing. And a lot of the killings that have been tallied or suggested in other works are sometimes the researchers themselves call them suspicious disappearances. So yes, some of those may be chimpanzees that were killed by other chimpanzees. But one of the things that I've argued is that we have a very good record now. It used to be thought that male chimpanzees would stay in the group where they were born, period, and females would emigrate from one to another. Now we know of lots and lots of cases of male chimpanzees who disappear when there's no disease, when there's no contact with any other group, and there's more on that.
How does this relate to the, I mean, I just want to get it clear. isn't it still correct that young males do change groups in chimpanzees, but adult males basically never do?
Well, that's what's becoming more clear about the changing. And some of the reports are, from my point of view, maddeningly unspecific. Generally speaking, I can say that it is still a rule that we have not seen broken so far, that a fully adult male chimpanzee has never been seen to permanently join another group because they have been seen to associate. You know, they associate for short periods or sometimes longer periods. So that's been seen. But a fully adult male not recorded as having fully joined another group, where we have seen that among bonobos a lot.
Yeah, yeah. As we turn a little bit to, before we go into the Gombe and the Kibale wars, how much should we read into this rare once in 30 years do these killings happen? Because there is, I could imagine a counter argument, which is that, yeah, sure, the killings happen pretty rarely because they don't have weapons. But what happens, what might happen every day is that there is border patrolling, there is a violent attack. And so, yes, even if they don't end up in killing, this is still the kind of behavior which has this eerie resemblance to what, obviously, once you give a little bit of weapons in hand, leads into what we would call war.
In territorial defense and territoriality in animal studies, the standard view, the almost universal view, is that a member of a species will not engage in physical violence that could result in harm. They advertise, that's a big word in territorial studies, you know, like bird calls, I'm here, keep away, or they will aggress but not attack. Now, what seemed to be different with chimpanzees is that they did attack and sometimes kill. Now, Richard Wrangham made this consistent with the ethology by saying they only do it when they have impunity, when there's no chance of them being harmed. So if there's six chimpanzees together and there's one male, then they could do it. But the standard behavior when chimpanzee groups meet or individuals meet is the standard behavior of ethology, which is that they move away. The smaller group or individual hears chimpanzees coming and moves away. People do that too. I coined a term for that in studying the wars of people in the Amazon forest. They call it an almost war, when things look like they're getting hostile, but it's resolved by moving apart. That's the normal behavior of chimpanzees. Now, the idea that they're going to take the opportunity, and one of the things that's, it may seem like a fine point, but it's a very important point, that in the demonic male theory, there's nothing that needs to be at stake in a conflict between chimpanzee groups. They don't have to be competing over food or even over females. It's merely the opportunity to kill members of the other group. That is both necessary and sufficient. And what you see is much more toleration or moving apart. Groups that encounter each other on a regular basis do not attack. And patrolling is another thing. This is something that's considered to be a universal. Not all chimpanzee groups patrol. Now, some you can explain because they're very arid areas and it's just too much land for them to cover. But in others, the researchers take pains to note when they see something that looks like a real patrol. And the difference, you know, an excursion, chimpanzees move as a group and they make noise and they feed and they do all that stuff. A patrol is a kind of a stealthy thing that looks like a human raid. And that's the kind of analogy I think you're going for.
Exactly.
At Mahali, there's only about two of them that have been recorded in about 50 years.
Okay. a good answer. Yeah. That's a good answer to the question. Yeah.
And so I think the patrolling is part of a specific kind of conflict where you have strong competition over resources. And by my theory, that strong competition over resources is due to human disruption. And that's what's been ruled out in primatology for these many years. And I'm bringing it back in.
So the big picture is that we really don't see these wars all the time. This is not the thing you expect to see when you meet chimpanzees. They are actually very rare events. And then the patrols and maybe attempts of killing, yes, of course, they're more common, but they are not daily things either, mm-hmm. nor weekly or monthly things either. What about these times when war does break out? I think that we can go through the into the weeds as much mm-hmm. as you want. Could you tell the story of what happened in Gombe?
Gombe's most famous. Jane Goodall had studied the chimpanzees at Gombe and come out with basically the opinion, I think there's a quote in there, that they're very much like us, but rather nicer, that there was nothing like war among them. But then the situation changed, and I do need to acknowledge Margaret Power, who wrote about Gombe long ago, and said that what we're seeing there is social change. It's not that they were wrong at first and right later on. The situation changed, and the situation was connected to the provisioning of bananas. Very large quantities of bananas were provided to the chimpanzees at Gombe, so they would come into a research camp and they could be observed. But they began to fight among themselves fiercely over these things. And they were even considering shutting the project down because it had gotten so violent, and directly over the bananas. Also, they had killings and violence with baboons, which otherwise they get along with, but it was over the bananas. So they devised a system where they dug a trench in like a concrete bunker, with trap doors that could be pulled by a wire, and they put some bananas behind them, and they would only spring the trap doors when there were few enough chimpanzees, so every chimpanzee who was there could grab a bunch and go off and eat it. So there was nothing to fight over, and that basically worked. But when Goodall went to Gombe, she was introduced to it by a game ranger. I'm not sure what his title was. Who told her that there are at least 5 chimpanzee communities in the park, and they center on these different areas. Well, Goodall confirmed that, but what she saw was chimpanzees from these different areas, particularly 2 of them, come together and run around and screech and sometimes bite each other, but then settle down to feed and sometimes go off with each other. Now, when they increased the number of bananas being fed at the research camp, the southern group, known as the Kahama group, began to come and stay around the research station, sometimes all the time. When they cut back, because before the cutback, a chimpanzee could get 50 bananas at one time. And when they cut back, their body weights dropped by roughly 20%. So that's a big change. But what they did do, And I don't say this to criticize the people who did it, because I probably would have done just the same thing, because we didn't know what I think I know now is that that's going to cause a lot of problems. So when the Kahama group began to drift away to go back to their own southern lands, whenever they came in, they would be fed and bananas, unlike the Kasakela chimps, that's the other group that was there all the time. And they would chase away the Kasakela chimpanzees.
What's the logic between with giving bananas only to one of these groups and not the other?
Because it wasn't there to be observed. They wanted to come more often.
So one was easy to observe even without bananas, and the other one you needed bananas to observe. Is that right?
Yeah. Once they cut back on the distribution, both groups started to spend less time around the feeding station. But the Kasakela still spent more time in the Kahama less.
So this was a conscious decision to keep feeding one group and not the other group?
Yes. Well, okay. Conscious decision in that it was stated, and you know, there's not a lot of statements about this, but in at least two or three quotes that I have in there, when they came, they were always fed. And that's right at the time that the four-year war developed. And it may be pushing chimpanzee cognitive abilities, but I don't think so, that the two groups developed a hostile relationship. I once asked some primatologists, do you think chimpanzees could hate? And they were kind of stumped by the question. If it was people, that would be the result. You know, people would see every time they come here, they get fed and we wait around all week and don't get anything. So people sometimes say provisioning causes intergroup violence. That is not my position. My position basically is, when human change, human disruption has an effect which pits two groups against each other, then you have the situation for violence. If everybody's getting fed, no.
And so this is where the typical responses go wrong, because they just aggregate any kind of human impact into kind of one variable instead of looking at what kind of a human impact it is.
Right. What doesn't cause group violence is when army troops in some war come through and shoot a lot of the animals. That doesn't lead them to fight each other, because it actually reduces population density. But one thing that does often lead to conflict and violence is when there is habitat loss, not in the area that is studied necessarily, but in nearby areas, which forces chimpanzees to move and increases density in competition. So the key thing is that it's resource competition, with which I agree with a lot of primatologists, but that to understand that resource competition, you have to look at the human impact in the area.
Yeah. Let's wrap up the story, Gombe. So these two groups have been asymmetrically fed with bananas. A lot of changes have happened very dramatically. Suddenly, you lose this massive windfall of calories, especially if you're in the Casakela group. Now we're in the 1970s, early 1970s.
In 1971 or something, the two groups began to drift apart. Until finally, there was no peaceful contact between them, except for two individuals, which did manage to go back and forth.
Wow. So they cut a couple of kind of cosmopolitans.
Yes. But those cosmopolitans both ended up being killed by Casakela. And not long after, they visited the feeding station and were fed. You know, originally, in the Gombe research, the original idea was of the war. And this included Jane Goodall but other PhD students who were there, is that what had happened was population density in Gombe had increased because human population outside the park pushed more chimpanzees in it. And this was, in the very first statements, theoretical statements about the war, what they thought was the primary cause for the violence. That's sort of faded out of the Gombe narrative.
Would you agree with that, Roslyn?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I would. But what Gombe researchers have never accepted is that provisioning led to really intense violence. Yeah. And one of the reasons is what seems sensible on the face of it. Most of the violence occurred after the provisioning was cut back. And I've already talked about the inequality. Yeah. In that cutback.
And how many kills, and what kind of kills? Can you describe the scene?
You have to read the book on that. I've got something like 179 entries in the kills to possible kills. At Gombe, these were smaller groups compared to other ones. And the smaller Kahama group, the one that disappeared, had, I think, only five adult males. I may be off in that. At the time they split.
Five adult males. Okay. They were all killed, right?
They're all presumed to be killed, but this is where I call a possible killing.
Okay.
Because for at least two of them, it was thought that the attacked chimpanzee was seen again after the attack. Now, in one, he was so battered that it seems hard to figure that he could have survived. But the other one wasn't all that bad. So, you know, do you count that as a kill or not? And a lot of these things are judgment calls, and I leave it to the reader to figure out how to count them. But there were, I believe, only two adult males and one adult female that I count as definite killings. And the answer to that may be, but there weren't any of the Kahama chimpanzees left. So they must have all been killed. But this goes back to the earlier point about chimpanzees sometimes leaving. You know, one thing about chimpanzees is that we know the chimpanzees we've studied, obviously. And people pick places to study for a number of reasons, but one of which is that there's a lot of chimpanzees there. Around Gombe, around Mahale, maybe different in Kibale Park because of its density, but around Gombe and Mahale, there is lots of land, territory, that doesn't have any identified chimpanzee groups in it, but does have signs of chimpanzees being there. And chimpanzees make a nest to sleep in on a tree every night. So they go in, they do surveys, and they count. That's much lower than in the central area, but there are chimpanzees out there, and we don't know anything about them.
That's really interesting. So is there a chance that the kind of group dynamics where there are relatively strong group boundaries, not as strong as I guess some people sometimes suggest, but pretty strong group boundaries, that might not be as much a universal, or at least is it okay to speculate that maybe that wouldn't be the universal chimpanzee pattern? It might be a typical pattern for very densely populated chimpanzee areas, and those just happen to be the ones we study for obvious reasons.
Well, I think that it's not just reason to believe, I think there's evidence for it.
Okay. One thing, I mean, well, let's get back to the kind of conclusions about Gombe, but before we do, I just want to highlight one interesting analogy that comes to mind, which is that when talking about not chimpanzee, but human war, for example, in the episode we did with Douglas Fry, one of the things that comes up over and over again is that if you look at, for example, hunter-gatherer populations, the best bet on where you might find war is places where for some ecological reason you get a really high density of settled people, which would also be like if you would imagine an alien scientist who wants to study, you know, hunter-gatherers, that those are the places they would land on studying because that's where you see a lot of them. So there is an interesting analogy there potentially. But looking at the Gombe again, as a whole, what we see is we don't have a pristine, untouched population of chimpanzees that constantly raid each other. What we have is that we have a deeply disturbed group of chimpanzees, which do not wage war for a long time, by the way. Like there was, 14 years of observation before there was anything like war. And then there is 4 years of war, and then there is peace again. And I think that this, even if we were to leave aside the whole story about banana provisioning, et cetera, which is super important, and the question marks around were everybody actually killed or not. Even all of that aside, I just think that in these kind of one-line summaries of, you know, chimps, what's typical for chimps is to just raid neighbors. And if you see a stranger, you kill them if it's safe for you. It just doesn't really fit with this most obvious pattern of there are these long stretches without war. And then there is something that needs to be explained. Why is there war in these 4 years? And then why does it go away? And as you said, you only find it in two places.
I do want to comment on that. I wouldn't say after the four-year war there was peace. There was another 2 or 3 years that was thought to be something of a duplication. It was called the invasion from the south. But there's no evidence of killing there. It's more of the displacement territoriality. However, when you go forward in time, when you get closer to the present, like when you get past 2003, 2006, there's a lot of killing going on. Most of it is internal. Chimpanzees killing other members of their own groups, adults or infants. Now, to just wrap up that point, similar things are seen elsewhere, but to wrap up that point, even if it's violent, it's not violent like war. I mean, it's like chimpanzee males killing infants of their own groups, some of whom they're the fathers of.
And you're, just to keep it very short, but I guess your explanation is that these are often troubled times and troubled individuals who do things that we shouldn't try to find a Darwinian explanation for.
Right. Well, I call it display violence, but people can look at the book for that.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, when we earlier mentioned that there is the kill every 30 years, just to get it right, there's a kill of a chimpanzee from another group every 30 years. Killing within the groups happens more often, right?
Right. Outside adult killing every 30 years.
Outside adults killing is once in
30 infants years. Infants are a whole different field.
Okay. But what about Kibale? I mean, the problem with the... When I read the Gombe story, I summarized it in one sentence to a friend of mine. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay, well, obviously that's not a very good study of what would be normal for chimpanzees if you have all this whole banana story. And I think that it's pretty easy to get people convinced that, yes, we see a capacity of chimpanzees to do this, but this is definitely not what's typical. But Kibale is a bit different because you don't have banana provisioning.
Correct.
You don't have resource stress like this dramatic decrease in body weight you see in Gombe. Mm-hmm. You actually have a lot of abundance in Kibale. Mm-hmm. And I've seen videos, which I will put in the I will put one in show notes. There's one which is narrated by David Attenborough. Just a 3-minute clip. And I'm 95% sure it's from Kibale.
Probably. And they have a lot of film.
And it is striking. It is striking not only because of the violence. It leads into appeal and cannibalism, which really looks like a more brutal version of the beginning of the 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
But what's more striking is the footage before the raid begins. You just cannot imagine a more human-like expression of tension, of sniffing for signs of the enemy. And this is an army of chimpanzees. I mean, it really is scary because it looks so familiar. And I'm thinking that, you know, we can talk as much as we want about the theory, about the problems with this. And I'm just saying, whoever sees that video, it was very difficult to see it as anything else than, oh my God, we must have been doing this for 6 million years since our common ancestor with chimpanzees. And so given that there is no banana provisioning, and given that this really is the thing to be explained, because those videos are eerily familiar to anyone who's seen guerrilla warfare in humans, what's the story of Kibale?
Well, I'll try and keep it shorter. There is resource competition, which I'll talk about. But you use the word capacity. I think chimpanzees have a capacity for something that looks very much like human warfare, just as you said. No quibbles with that. But why was this series of attacks on a northeastern neighbor? Why did that occur? What's the human impact? It's not because of banana provisioning. There wasn't any. I think there's a few factors. All of these are based on what the Ngogo researchers themselves have written. Number one, that this area formerly had human habitation, and back a century ago, and humans left behind a kind of ficus tree, a fig tree, that is always abundant. There's always food, and there's a lot of other food there as well. So they have enough food. They're not malnourished. They're well nourished.
Yeah.
But there are some foods, and this is a distinction I make throughout the book, that are preferred foods. There are groups, you know, like plum-like things that have lots of nutrients, and there is flesh from killing monkeys. These get the most attention by Ngogo chimpanzees and by their neighbors. And often clashes occur when the chimpanzee groups, the Ngogo groups, are pursuing those preferred foods. Now, why they expand? And one of the things that's so impressive about the videos, it's like an army, like, holy shit, you know, look at that. And all the Ngogo researchers agree that the reason Ngogo has been successful at expanding and killing off some neighbors is because there are so many of them. They had gotten up to about 150 to 160 chimpanzees in one group. Chimpanzee groups normally, I mean, some are down like 20 or 80.
Yeah, 150 is just huge.
Huge.
And by the way, this harks back to the earlier point about population density in humans, well, for example, hunter-gatherers. And this is like the most densely populated area of chimps ever studied, right?
Yes. And when a bunch of primatologists put together a kind of a preemptive strike on my position in the journal Nature a few years ago. They point this out, that the things that seem to be most correlated to killing or higher levels of killing is density and numbers of males present. So the question is, why? And what I've argued, when in that same article, they'll talk about things of human impact that they can discount. And one of them is that there's been habitat destruction within the studied area. There hasn't been within Ngogo. There hasn't been habitat. What there's been is great habitat destruction around the park where they are. And in some places, there is only enough physical space for one chimpanzee group to exist between them and the park border, where the human impact is strongest. And outside the park, human impact has devastated chimpanzee foods. So chimpanzees that lived had to go into the park. And I've suggested that a couple of things may be in play in Ngogo. One of them is that the big Ngogo group of what became 150, actually more than one group, that had been pushed together by circumscription, by impaction. And that seems to be getting more support with recent developments where it suggests that this group has split again, although I don't know much about that. The other is that females, which always or generally migrate when they reach sexual maturity, that only go from outside the park or in the strip of borderland, go towards Ngogo. And so what Ngogo had was this really unusual number of fecund females at the same time who became pregnant, who produced males. And when you look at one point, Mitani in one of his, not the film that's out there now, but the one before it, I think it's called Rise of the Killer Apes. He says, and I quote him in the book, that it may be this demographic blip. All these males got born at the same time. And then when they grew up, well, hell broke loose. Well, why did all these males get born at the same time? And I think it's because that was the time when chimpanzee females were being forced into their territory. So what you got was a large group and real competition over the preferred foods. And I'll just, the droops I'll leave. But the hunting. Hunting is very important for some chimpanzees. And we're talking about, as I put it at one place, a burger a day. It's not just little bits. The Ngogo group got so large and hunted so often that they basically exterminated their monkey prey within their own area. And what I show by going through case by cases is that when they make attacks on this group to their northeast, almost all of them are connected to some interest of the attackers in hunting monkeys. So it grew with the preferred foods, got extirpated, and they went out looking. And the last point is that at Gombe, the Kasekela and Kahama groups were both accustomed to human observers. At Ngogo, that wasn't the case. The Ngogo group was accustomed, and the group whose territory they entered was not accustomed. And chimpanzees that see people who are not habituated run away.
Oh, so the Ngogo group has a kind of superpower, which is they have this really scary group of humans following them around.
These chimps come in, and then once they settle in there, and they say, well, after a while, they went there on a routine basis, and you didn't see the other chimps around. You wouldn't see the other chimps around when there's people there and they're not habitual.
I mean, okay, so is the response then roughly as, okay, yeah, sure, Kibale National Park, the Ngogo group there shows this capacity for eerily human-like attacks, but that's far from being something of a demonstration of an untouched pristine chimpanzee nature. This is a very, very particular area with extremely high population density, etc., due to human impact.
They can learn to make war just as people do. But my point is that neither has an inclination to make war.
Yeah. Yeah, but hold on. I think that's really an important distinction, because there's one thing that I don't, you know, I would love to have someone like Rangan back on the show and maybe elaborate and defend his position. But before that, I have to say that you made a pretty convincing case that no, it is not the case, as some, at least some individual quotations from people like Rangan might suggest, that this is just the most typical thing you would expect from a chimpanzee, is that if they see a stranger, they will gang up. Okay. But that aside, I think that then the question is, okay, so why do these wars sometimes happen? Mm-hmm. And there I think that we can take human impact in two different ways. One is that humans in some sense corrupt, teach violence to these chimpanzees. There wouldn't have been war without humans. Before humans, there wouldn't have been war amongst chimpanzees. And then there's another way to think about, which is a much more human impact light, which is that yes, during the past 100 years or so, whenever there is some really dramatic ecological change, it's probably because of humans. I mean, the kind of the idea of the Anthropocene, you know, whatever, any changes, you see, it's going to be human and induced change. So yes, any dramatic changes, which would then lead to war, is because of humans. But things like habitat loss, things like rapidly increasing population in one area, things like changing diets, I mean, these things would have been going on for the whole time that chimpanzees or proto-chimpanzees have been alive, not because of humans at that time. And so I just want to kind of clarify, how far do you interpret the human impact? Is it that humans are really bringing something completely novel, and that the war in Kibale is something that we would never expect to see in a kind of pre-human era, versus, yes, these things would have happened, maybe rarely, but they happen when there are things like really dramatic habitat loss somewhere and high food density in another place. And nowadays, those things are because of humans, but back in the days, it could have been because of something else.
Yeah, the latter. And it's much the same as my position about hunters and gatherers. Could it possibly be that sometimes 100,000 years ago, there was climate change and vast populations were condensed and led to violence? Yes.
I think that a lot of people who will come back critically about your book without necessarily having properly read it is because they will misunderstand this point. I think that the idea that human impact explains, for example, the war in Kibale, all these Sengogo raids, is because they have learned. I mean, you used the term learning earlier, and I think that's where I kind of flinched and was like, well, hold on a second, learn. I don't know if learning is right, or maybe using violence.
I think you're correct here. I use the word learn loosely. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I don't want to pick your words just to prove a point, but the reason this really matters is that when I went through Jane Goodall's writings, not Rangan's, but Goodall's writings, what she writes is nothing of the, every chimpanzee is going to try to kill another one if they have a cheap chance to do it. What she says is that, and I can actually quote her, let me find this. She said that by the end of the 1970s, I had come to accept that the dark and evil side of human nature was deeply rooted in our ancient past. We had strong predisposition to act aggressively in certain kinds of contexts, and they were the same contexts: jealousy, competition for food or sex or territory, fear, revenge, and so on, that triggered aggression in chimpanzees, unquote. So first of all, this is a more qualified statement. But more importantly, what she says is that she was in a conference in, I think it was in the 80s, it was a UNESCO conference in Paris, where people were debating issues around war and peace. And she was shocked of how many people were unwilling to engage or take seriously her findings about war and chimpanzees, because they were so convinced that whatever violence we see in humans, it must be learned. And quote, they argued, by dint of eliminating all experience of violence and aggression, all stories about it, all nationalism, all martial music, all competition, all punishment, and all sorts of other experiences from the lives of children, we should succeed in creating a utopian society without aggression, unquote. And so from her point of view, she doesn't take this really extreme view that I think is relatively easy to debunk.
Right.
She takes a more nuanced view. And now I'm not sure if there is much of a disagreement then between your position and her position.
Well, we'll see when she responds. But the difference, I think, is one difference is the way she set it up then was taken by other people and made this kind of almost mechanistic theme. But some of the things that she says are like that chimpanzee males are predisposed. They find it exciting. They seek it out to have some kind of a confrontation with members of other groups. That happens in many human groups, but in many other human groups, you don't see that at all. So when I look at, there are many things that you can say about human hunters and gatherers or others in their fighting that resemble things that chimpanzees do, but only sometimes. It's a difference between a capacity and a predisposition. And I say the same thing about humans.
Well, what do you then make of the idea of there being, if not a lust to kill, then at least some kind of a, more than just a capacity, certain kind of temptation, going back to where we started from with Freud, et cetera. I mean, now that I put up my Jane Goodall quotes, maybe I can even read what she said exactly about this. She said, quote, "It was obvious too that some male chimpanzees, particularly the younger ones, found intercommunity conflict absolutely thrilling." And then she goes on to say that, "We know only too well how human beings are fascinated by death and suffering. Public hanging were amongst the most popular of events in medieval England. Just today, as I am writing this chapter, August 1997, I read in the newspaper how 10,000 people gathered in Western Tehran for the execution of a convicted rapist," unquote. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess we're going more into speculative theory and less in hard-nosed chimpanzee research, but for coming from your background, academic position, mm-hmm. how do you think about the love of gladiators and public hangings? And
I don't think any person alive, unless they're really sick in some ways, has read more horrible things that people have done to each other than myself. You know, I've been studying war for a long time, patterns of torture, for example. And I was talking to an archaeologist once about, I believe it was Mongols. This is an area that he worked in. And he was telling me that they had a pattern of when they decided to destroy a city or a town, which if the people gave up first, they wouldn't destroy it. But if they didn't give up and they fought, then they would kill every living thing they could find. But they always knew something would come crawling out of the rubble, you know, a baby, a dog. And so they would send people back, soldiers back a few days later to kill anything that survived. And we were talking about how could people do that? And he said that they were being good Mongols. That's what their culture trained them to do. There are all these atrocities, but there are also, on the other side of this, all these societies that are, to us, just remarkably peaceful, where they don't show those behaviors. And most are in between. One of my mentors and then a friend of mine, Brian Burkhalter, who passed away way too young, worked with a group of Amazonian peoples called the Mundurucú. And the Mundurucú is one of these interesting examples. They have an extreme suppression of any sort of open antagonism or aggression. So I asked Brian, did he ever see any act of physical aggression? And he said one time a man got frustrated and pushed another man, just pushed him. And everybody went, and nobody ever mentioned it again. And he was there. There was a town there then. And they would show films on a screen or a sheet or something. And they showed Mundurucú, the first Rambo movie. And he said that they were just stunned, didn't understand it, wouldn't talk about it. They just didn't understand what was going on there. So we know that people can be that way. But we live in a world that's had war for, in most places, for millennia. And even in places we know around the world, this is another thing I go into about how Western contact increased war among indigenous people by a great, great deal. But still, most indigenous people, by the time Columbus set sail, had some familiarity with war. And I talk about why that changed over the millennia. So we live in a world with war. And when you live in a world like that, it's difficult to understand, to answer the question, well, why wouldn't they go out and kill these other people? But as a thought experiment, I thought that, say you had a society with little villages or bands, and they may have had conflicts and other things, but something happened, and one or a couple of people started saying, let's just go out there and kill them. But they've never had war. Let's just go out there and kill them. What would the reaction to that be? And I think the reaction, you know, as a thought experiment would be, what's wrong with you? Why would you think of doing something like that? But that would be in a world without war. In all the other worlds, it's, well, we can think about that. You know, maybe we'll do it. And when there are small groups, an individual can shape the group dynamics. But people can learn to love torturing others and seeing them suffer. That happens. That's not a human characteristic, other than humans can learn to do it. I mean, there's one area I disagree. Leslie Sponsel is a very good anthropologist, and he talks about the human proclivity towards peace. He talks about cooperation, cooperation being part of not just humans, but other animals. And Douglas Fry does that too. And you could say that humans are not inherently prone to war. They're inherently prone to cooperate. I think that that's true. But the problem for me is that it's also pointed out by people in another position that war is the example par excellence of cooperation. You know, it's by cooperating that they're able to go to war. One person killing another is not war. Groups cooperate to do it. So I know and appreciate and like the work on cooperation, but I think that adhering to a null hypothesis in terms of human predispositions and invoking plasticity is what is more persuasive. You know, why have the dial set on attack rather than the dial set in neutral? And it can go either way.
Well, that's a wonderful metaphor, by the way, about the dial. I guess the reason you got into this debate, despite being an anthropologist and not a primatologist, is that the chimpanzee war is often used as one argument amongst many to the conclusion that war goes, as I believe you coined the phrase, war goes forever back. And we don't have much time. We did have a lot of time with Doug Fry, and I think that was an episode I've thought about a lot, and I can highly recommend to people who want to learn more about the anthropology side of this to go to that. That's episode 8. And so I'm wondering, what exactly do I want to ask, given the limitations that we have? Where, for people who see the chimpanzee raid in the Kibale National Park, narrated by David Attenborough, and who read about people before gunpowder, empires and European colonists coming up, killing each other, what would you say to them about what you think they get wrong when they just conclude, aha, war goes forever back?
Years ago, when I was telling my mother many years ago about where my work was leading, and I got pretty much the same response from my mother-in-law. My mother said, oh, come on, just look at history. And I think that that's what a lot of people think. And history is full of it. Also, it's not just is it full of it, but it's written about, whereas non-war is not written about. My point is that a future without war is theoretically possible. And when I told this to my archaeological friend, she said, not with this species. Well, that's what I'm arguing against. It is possible. I don't know how to get there. I don't know whether we ever will. But I think what's important is for people to not take what they see in movies and TV and say, well, we like to see it because we enjoy it.
But It cannot be that it is cultural learning originally that brings war to the stage, because you can't learn war if you're the first one doing war in your area. Every place has the beginning. So you earlier said this dial that you don't want to think that human nature is predisposed to the dial being this way or that way. It's probably the best hypothesis that it's neutral, and then you can take it either way. What is it that takes us from an era of war to an era of war?
World with war? Like yeah, that. Well, that's just to sum it up. My position is that most of the time, when you have, there's a time without war and then there's war, what happens for that transition? And I talk about preconditions for war. More of these things present. We're never going to know what made the first shot be fired. We're never going to answer the question that I just posed, other than it might be people already hate each other. But it's things like population density. It's development of social hierarchy. It's concentration of valuable resources. These I call preconditions for war. But there are also, and this I learned from Doug Fry, things that you could call preconditions for peace that are independent of the preconditions for war. So one of the areas that I find remarkable in the archaeological record is in the southern Levant of Mediterranean coast, from like lowland Syria down into Israel. We go from about 13,000 BC to 3200 BC, so 10,000 years, without any clear evidence that war was present. Now, there are a couple of suspicious cases, and I say, keep looking. Look. You know, maybe you'll find it. But there isn't any clear evidence of that. And why they had preconditions for war, with like population density, climatic reversals, other things, but they also had preconditions for peace, such as communal burial areas where your ancestors aren't buried underneath your house. You're buried someplace else where all ancestors are buried, that kind of thing. Then that area, just to wrap it up, became, I mean, you can't think of the Near East as being a peaceful place. And it wasn't after 3200 BC. And what happened in 3200 BC was the pharaohs came in. The rise of the pharaohs, and then I describe it in one of my archaeological papers, that can be really closely tied to the development of things like walls around villages, that kind of stuff. So I think you can ask these questions, but when people say war has always been there, you don't even get to the questions. You've got to pose the question and try to answer it.
What's the window where you don't find any evidence of war anywhere and you would see it if there was war?
I think you'd go back at least 100,000 years, more like 140,000 years. However, you don't have much evidence for those. I mean, when you get back that deep, you're not going to find settlements, which is one of the key areas of evidence for war. You're basically reduced to looking at bones. That's what you look for. You can't even really distinguish a hunting weapon from a human killing weapon. Sometimes you can, but most times you can't. So it's really the bones. And when you go back to like 40,000 years ago, you don't have whole skeletons. You know, you got a couple of teeth, you know, and a skull fragment, things like that. So I perfectly grant that there is a wide, long time span when there could be war and we wouldn't see any evidence of it. My point is that when you have areas that do have good archaeological recovery, for instance, the Near East, which has been dug completely almost, what you see, and in the Near East, the settlement information is paramount. You have a long period of time when there's no indication of war. And when there's war in an area, people take precautions. They don't live in stretched out little hamlets on low land, you know, or they build walls, they go up into pinnacles, things like that. I don't see any of that. And then it appears. And then when you see it appear, it doesn't go away. And so my point is, if you have good archaeological recovery, which most of the Pleistocene doesn't have, when you have good archaeological recovery for many sites over a long period of time and there's no signs of war, and then you get signs of war, then you can say war has begun in that area.
So wherever we have a good archaeological record of an area, it always has a period of peace before a period of war. It never starts with war, suggesting that war comes.
I won't say every place, but that's the norm.
Is there a way in which, if we simplify the model, that the preconditions to war as being about some kind of dramatic intensification, more and more people on a small area, and then clear separation for one reason or another between that that group and some other groups, and if we take those to be not necessarily the causes but the preconditions to war, would you say that the chimpanzee war in Kibale would, in a sense, actually support the theory, because we see something similar in chimpanzees when you have this intensification of a huge amount of chimpanzees squeezed into a small area?
Yeah, but chimpanzees don't have culture. I think that they have traditions. And I give more weight to traditions than some people who argue that they have culture give to traditions. I think the difference between one chimpanzee group that seems to be quite violent and another which is less so, or even between chimpanzees and bonobos, is in part because of different traditions that they learn growing up. But culture is something that they do not have. And part of, well, I talk about the preconditions for war or preconditions for peace. One of the things that's very hard to recover archaeologically is the belief systems that are there. What's the ideology? We know in ethnographic societies that societies that don't have war or don't even have personal violence actively discourage it, ostracize it, that it's verboten, it's forbidden. And some other societies, it's, you know, very much the opposite. It's hard to see those, if you can see them at all, in the ancient Near East. I mean, I think, you know, what I mentioned, the idea that all of our ancestors are buried together could be part of an ideology that brings people together. But there's no way to recover that ideology directly.
Okay, well, final question before we end. All the research since the 70s and since the Vietnam years, all the way to studying the chimpanzees of Gombe, Kibale, etc. How has all of that work shaped your outlook on our species?
Well, very deeply. I mentioned before, I don't think chimpanzees have culture. You know, there's a great tendency, I think, to say, people are just members of the animal kingdom. So, you know, chimpanzees make tools, chimpanzees hunt, that kind of stuff. All true. But culture is this symbolic linguistic sphere that gives meaning to everything. It's something that we don't see chimpanzees as having. I mean, chimpanzee traditions are things that, like learning to dip twigs to harvest termites. You know, that's a classic example. But I think chimpanzee traditions go beyond that, that chimpanzee traditions can go into things like how aggressive a young male growing up learns to be. So more traditions, but it's still not the same thing as culture, which requires thought and symbolism and communication and language. And while I tend to focus on material or economic or ecological factors, wars don't happen unless they go through a person's head and that imbues them with meaning. And that meaning can be very important in going to war or not going to war, or attacking one group or attacking a different group. All those things bring in meaning. And this is one reason why I put chimpanzee war in quotes. And that's one difference, which I didn't appreciate before. The other is what has been called the ratchet effect of culture, that everything we're doing now, us having this conversation here, is all a result of an infinite series of innovations that go back in time to very crude things. That doesn't happen with chimpanzees. You know, the war in Ukraine is, people compare it to World War I because of the trenches. That's true. But in many ways, it's completely unlike World War One, or very unlike World War One. You know, drone warfare, et cetera, satellite imagery. All of these things are built up. So I have come to respect chimpanzees and bonobos by learning about them and learn something about this, what I've talked about before, this capacity versus predisposition, by comparing humans and chimpanzees, and see that I just don't think that the sociobiological kind of evolutionary theory helps us understand war today. I think you have to look at these things that make us different. The fact of this cumulative development of cultural practices and objects, and this symbolism with which we view war.
Professor Brian Ferguson, thank you so much.
Okay, see you around.
So that was it. That was the 25th episode of the On Humans podcast. I hope that you enjoyed it. If you did, then please do consider supporting the show. It can be something as simple as referring it to a friend, subscribing to it, giving a nice review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, etc. Or if you want to support financially, that would be very, very warmly welcomed and appreciated. You can now do so via patreon.com and just find On Humans podcast there and decide on this kind of small sum that would suit you well. Anyway, I hope that you decide to tune in next time. Until then, take care.